So last week I spoke about some of the interactions that the Protestant reformers had with Islam, some of the ways they thought about Islam. And when I tell people that I got a PhD studying Islam and Protestantism, one of the inevitable questions that comes up, because it's a popular formulation, is this one. Does Islam need a reformation? Or most people frame it more, well, I think that Islam needs a reformation. It's usually not even framed as a question. So I've thought a lot about this question, especially with some of the movements within Islam that I study. And so I want to maybe take a different approach to thinking about this question. Take a different way to understand what we even mean by this question or this concept of a reformation in Islam. So I want to first talk about what our mantra today will be. And I'm a comparativist. I do comparative work between Islam and Christianity. And one of the things that we have learned in comparative religion over the last really century or so, really the last few decades especially, is that we have tended to take our own religious tradition, assume that that is exactly how every other religious tradition in the world works, and then demand of those other religious traditions that they conform to that definition that we have of ourselves. And so one of the methodological checks that we have in comparative religion is to always say that no two religious traditions follow the exact same historical path. In some ways, saying does Islam need a reformation is similar to saying does Buddhism need a reformation, or does Hinduism need a reformation? That's a bit of a strange question to ask of these religious traditions that are so different. But we all have our narratives. We all have our ways of thinking about our own history, and then we want other people to fit the narrative that we have about our own history. Nonetheless, it's a popular framing to talk about Islam needing a reformation. One of the biggest proponents of this is this woman, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. So she was raised in a Muslim community in East Africa and felt very brutalized by the experience of Islam there, particularly by not necessarily her own family, but by some of the members of the community there. And so she has been one of these spokespeople for this idea that Islam needs a reformation. She wrote this book recently, Heretic, and she puts it quite boldly in the subtitle there, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now. And so here's roughly her argument in outline form. She says, Islam is not a religion of peace. Muslims are involved in nearly all the major conflicts in the world. There's something intrinsically violent about the Muslim tradition, and to claim that it's a religion of peace is a misnomer, is a mistake. She says that Islam's sacred texts, the Quran and the Hadith are a secondary or complementary scripture within Islam. They're the sayings and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad and his companions, and they're used to interpret the Quran. I'll talk a little bit more about those in a bit. But she says those texts call people to violence. They incite violence. And she'll note then that not all Muslims are violent, but most Islamic cultures are retrograde because they are following those sacred texts. And she'll sometimes put forward a formulation of what Muslims need to do is give up Islam. Islam itself is problematic, but Muslims, not all Muslims, are bad. And then she'll conclude by pointing out that Christians and Jews in the West have learned how to, quote, consign the violent passages from their sacred texts to the past. And they exist in modernity, and they're fine now, so it's time for Muslims to catch up. It's time for Muslims to arrive at this similar, modern, reformed formulation of religion. Now, I have a lot of issues with the way that Ayaan Hirsi Ali thinks about these things, but I'll acknowledge that she is not a scholar, and she is not especially a scholar of the Reformation. And so I think in the ways that many people think about the Reformation, this fits the narrative that we have about the Reformation. And that narrative goes something like this. This is a story that we usually tell about the Reformation. And it usually begins with the Renaissance, the 14th to 17th centuries roughly, this flourishing of arts and culture and literature, this focus, as we saw last week, on recovering classical texts, recovering the classical culture of the Greek and Roman period over and against those bad, bad middle dark ages, right? The Renaissance really kind of polemically attacked everything that came in between classical Roman culture and their own time and said those were the dark ages. And then we'll situate the Reformation against that background. Coming along in the 16th century, the Reformation then is overthrowing the rigid hierarchies of late medieval culture. It casts away superstition and mysticism and puts people back on track. Christians focused on the Bible that has now been unshackled but from the hierarchical interpretations of the Catholic Church, the interpretive monopoly that the Catholic Church had over it, so that everyone can read the Bible, everyone can interpret it for themselves. And then we jump straight from there to the Enlightenment and this movement of philosophy that elevates reason over dogma. And many people, the way we tell the story, see the Reformation with its democratization of knowledge, pushing towards this movement of the Enlightenment, advocating liberty and equality and fraternity, all of our modern, impressive values, and applying science in a triumph over nature so that suddenly we can have technological revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and all of the modern technologies and cell phones and toilets that we like today. And then we arrive at this period we call modernity, where we have basically arrived at the pinnacle of human civilization. We have developed democracy to ensure our individual rights. We protect human rights as our supreme duty, and that everyone recognizes that everyone else has these human rights. And we have an increasing pluralism and tolerance and acceptance of diversity. So that is the story as we typically tell it, right? A march of progress, a march of growing independence and individualism and freedom, and a march of enlightened rationality guiding our morality into the experience of being modern people. And to be fair, that's not a false narrative. That's not a lie. There's truth to all the pieces of that. There really is an intellectual continuity between the Renaissance and the Reformation and the Enlightenment and what we think of as modern society. There really has been a growth in our ability to flourish as human beings. I would much rather be a human being in the 21st century than be a human being in the 14th century, right? The experience is better. And I would much rather have this concept of human rights than be subject to the whims and wills of a dictator or monarch. God forbid, right, that we go back in time, go back into all of these bad things. But there is another side to this story. There's another side to all of these experiences, and it's a side that we don't talk about very much. It's the story that we don't tell about the Reformation up into the modern period. When we think about the Renaissance was a wonderful flourishing of arts and culture, but it also involved Nicholas Machiavelli, right? And the Inquisition was happening contemporaneously with the Renaissance. The witch hunts that began in that period actually grew. It was the witch hunts were not necessarily a phenomenon of the medieval period. They were a phenomenon of the Renaissance period. There's a growing sense of there are threats and the superstitious magic that is haunting our society. There's a social backlash against a lot of different groups of people during the Renaissance. A lot of people were seen as inferior. And a number of scholars who've looked at it have argued that the gender relationships between men and women got worse during the Renaissance than they were in the medieval period. That during the medieval period, there was a de facto parity and recognition that men and women could operate together, could fulfill many of the same functions. But with the Renaissance came a more ideological understanding of gender that forced people into these separated gender roles that we are still grappling with today. So the Renaissance was a good thing, but it also involved a lot of problematic elements. When we come to the Reformation, we tend to think of the Reformation, again, as this movement towards freedom, this movement towards enlightened readings of the Bible. reality is that as soon as people started reading the Bible for themselves, they started disagreeing about what the Bible said and how it should be read and what should be understood. And if you go back and read the actual writings from the Protestant reformers, they were often as animated and angry with their fellow Protestants as they ever were with Catholics. Martin Luther thought that what we call the Radical Reformation, the Anabaptist element in the Reformation, was worse than the Catholics. And he saw them, and if you read some of the things, some of the worst things that Martin Luther wrote were about the Jews, but right after that would really come the Anabaptists in many respects. So you have, as soon as the Bible is being read by everyone, well, I read this differently than you. And it's not that they are reading different passages, but they're sometimes reading the same passage and coming to very different conclusions. One of the moments in the Reformation that is maybe the most disheartening is at one point early on in the Reformation, as you start having these different branches, the Anabaptists, the not quite the Anglicans yet, but the Reformed tradition is starting to congeal. All of these big major figures get together, and they're like, we should really be a unified movement. We should really have a unified perspective. Let's sit down and have a theological dialogue. Let's come and figure out what we all agree on together. And they have 14 points that they're going to go through. Why is it always 14 points? 14 points that they're going to go through and come to this conclusion. So they go through each of them, and they agree on the first 13, and they get to the 14th point, and it's the Lord's Supper. And Martin Luther's perspective is similar to the Catholics, although not quite as far as the Catholics, that there somehow is a real presence of Christ in the elements, that there's a mysterious presence of God in these elements. And the Anabaptists say, well, no, it's really just more of it's mysterious, but it's really just more of a representation. We're just remembering through the Lord's Supper what what Christ did for us. And Calvin is there, and he's like, well, it's the presence of God is under the bread and the wine. And everyone's like, what do you mean? And he says, it's under. Right, he's trying to not pick a position. He's trying to find some way to thread the needle. And by the end of this conversation that they have, Luther has pulled out his pocket knife, carves into the table, "This is my body," and leaves. And there's never unity among the different Reformed traditions or the different Protestant traditions. And what happens over the course of the Reformation, over the next 50, 60, even 100 years, you have religious wars that just ravage Europe. Not just between Catholics and Protestants, but also between Protestants and Protestants, and sometimes alliances of Protestants and Catholics against a certain type of Protestants. And at one point, the Turkish Muslims get involved, and the French make an alliance with the Turks against some of the Protestants. Right? So it chaos just engulfs Europe for roughly the next 100 years after the Reformation. And it's only at the end of the 30 Years' War in 1648 that you have the Peace of Westphalia that basically creates the foundations for the modern secular state. That every nation state is going to govern its own people within its boundaries, and that nation state has power over religion within its own boundaries, and other nation states will not interfere with those boundaries. And so you have the rise of the secular nation state as a way to counterbalance the inequities and problems and the chaos that is created by the Reformation. So, yes, the Reformation is a huge step forward. I think most of us would be in agreement that it helps in many ways the conversation in Christianity, but it also creates some problems of its own. When we come to the Enlightenment, what bad thing could you say about the Enlightenment? Well, let me try. The Enlightenment corresponds with the rise of the slave trade, the triangular trade. And many of the debates that are going on in this new rational mode of the Enlightenment are not just about the nobility and dignity of human personhood, but who is a person, who counts as a human being. And the slaveholders and pro-slavery advocates are very much framing their own arguments in terms of the Enlightenment and saying, well, people of different skin color obviously are not rational because they aren't having our philosophical conversation. Right, so the Enlightenment itself contributes to some of the racialization theories that arise in the centuries afterwards. The Industrial Revolution occurs, which of course really helps us all out, gives us all kinds of new technologies, makes modern cities, but it also involves massive exploitation. You have children under the age of 10 working 7 days a week, sometimes 12 hours a day in these factories doing menial labor. Right? New technology does not necessarily lead to the ennobling of all humanity. It often leads to the exploitation of some segment of humanity. And the reason that this rationality that these Enlightenment philosophers are talking about actually dissolves their faith in many cases and leaves them prone more towards Thomas Jefferson's form of deism or Benjamin Franklin's form of deism, that God could not be involved in the icky, nasty world that we live in. God must, maybe there was a God who started everything, but now we humans are on our own. So, and many of those Enlightenment philosophers were themselves raised as Protestants. There are a few who are Catholic, but many of them are Protestants who have been indoctrinated with some of these notions, and they see the confessionalism, they see the segmentation of Protestantism and say, well, obviously none of these people get it right, because otherwise they would all agree. So the Enlightenment itself has a dark side, although you wouldn't know it from the name. And then we come to the modern Western world, the world that we live in, and that too is a troubling place in many respects. We have what we call the world wars, but they actually were largely Western wars, wars fought through and about Europe and European politics. And they're based on political and national ideologies, ideologies, by the by, that grew up in the Enlightenment. Confessionalism and nationalism, all these ideas that we are still grappling with, communism, these ideas that we are still grappling with today, grew out of Enlightenment philosophy. They were Western ideologies that grew out of these conversations. We now have weapons that we are still fearing could hold the power to decimate and destroy humanity as we know it, that are inventions of our modern world. We have intra and inter-religious conflicts that continue in our modern world that are shaped by tribalism, by new and enshrined identities. C.S. Lewis used to say that the founding myth of Western civilization is the myth of human progress. It's a myth, not necessarily in that it's entirely false. We have made progress, but we govern and guide our lives around this conception of we are better than past generations. And that betterness often contributes to our conception of morality. We are morally better than those past generations. I would say that experientially, that's not necessarily true. Empirically, that's not necessarily true. We have not necessarily transcended the tribalism of past generations. I was shocked, but not entirely surprised, when after the recent election in 2016, in the Ronald Reagan building in downtown D.C., a group of white nationalists who called themselves the alt-right gathered around this activist, Richard Spencer, who has his salon down here in Old Town Alexandria. And they gathered at the Ronald Reagan building. This was in November after the election. And Richard Spencer led his fellow white supremacists in a chant of Hail Trump. And they gave the Hitler salute. And somebody videotaped this surreptitiously and it got posted on YouTube. If we think that we have moved beyond the past, we haven't. Those same challenges and issues. So my point is not that the narrative we tell about the Reformation is wrong, but it's incomplete. And it's in that incompleteness, we have a tendency to selectively remember the experience of the Reformation as an entirely good thing, as an unmitigated good that has made our world such a wonderful and positive place. But I think we need to remember the shadow side of that process as well, especially when we start thinking about other religious traditions. So we come back to our mantra. No two religious traditions follow the exact same historical path. So for us to take even the shadow side narrative and apply it to Islam would be a misnomer, a mistake. But are there similarities? Are there similar experiences and instances that we can see happening in the Muslim world that we can maybe draw some parallels to? I think there are. So I want to talk first about some of the crucial contexts for understanding modern Muslim history. Many people have maybe caught the edges of this, but I want to approach it in a little bit more of a systematic way. So Right around the same time as the American Revolution, there's a movement in Sunni Islam in Saudi Arabia. It wasn't called Saudi Arabia at the time. It was just called Arabia. It was one of the provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And this leader named Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab arises. And Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab he's a very strict Sunni. He has this kind of puritanical instinct. And he believes that Islam needs to be reformed. He's frustrated with what he sees as all the cultural accretions that have been added on to Islam. Sufi mysticism, shrines to different saints, people doing practices that were not rooted in the original Islamic experience. And so he leads this movement of hard-edged reformism, stripping away the what he sees as cultural accretions, the innovations that have been attached onto Islam over the centuries, to go back to what he sees as a pure and pristine vision of what Islam originally was. It's an incredibly violent movement. It's a movement of iconoclasm, of tearing down images and anything that would mediate between God and humanity. And there, in the Wahhabis' vision, we need to have just direct, unmediated relationship with God. We don't need saints. We don't need intercessors. We don't need any sort of mystical practice. We should just have strict prayer. And this movement winds up taking over the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina. And again, this is right around the same time as the American Revolution. And one of the things that Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab realizes is that for him to have his religious movement, he needs political cover. And so he finds a local tribal chief named Muhammad ibn Saud. And he says to Muhammad ibn Saud, he says, look, I will control the religious sphere, and I will support you as the political leader, and if you will just protect me and give me the cover that I need to enact my religious reforms. Muhammad ibn Saud says, sounds like a pretty good deal to me. And so he goes and starts making war on all of the other tribes around there, declaring jihad against them. And Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab gives the kind of religious support to back up this movement. Now, the Ottoman Empire, that is technically in control of this area, although it's the Arabian Desert, and so they've never really had direct control over it, decides, okay, this is problematic. And they send in an army, knock down the whole thing, push them into a corner of the Arabian Peninsula, where this movement remains for little over 100 years. And then at the beginning of the 20th century, the great-great-great-grandson of Muhammad ibn Saud and the great-great-great-great-grand-descendants of Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab say, let's get it going again. And they just happen to have found oil in Saudi Arabia. And so the family of Saud becomes the ruling royal family, hence the term Saudi Arabia. And the Wahhabi clerics become the governing and ruling religious police and religious enforcers and scholars of the area. Now again, they wind up taking control over the two holy cities. They become part of the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so all Muslims, if they have the ability, are encouraged to go on the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, at least once in their lives. So you have every year hundreds of thousands, today millions of Muslims coming to Saudi Arabia, seeing what they believe is authentic Islam. But that authentic Islam is being governed and guided by these Wahhabi ideas. And so this becomes then an incredibly influential movement within Islam. And once you have oil wealth, the Saudis, both as part of their foreign policy, but also just as part of what they believe is true Islam, export their vision of Islam, pay for mosques, pay for publishing of the Quran, of all kinds of other Islamic literature that they like, and spread that around the world. Many of the Quran, the English translations of the Quran that are present even here in the U.S. have been funded by this Saudi Wahhabi money and are translated in line with their vision of what Islam is. So moving a little bit forward from the 18th and 19th century, we also have the movement of European colonialism. And Europe, in this period, occupies and humiliates much of the Islamic world. Some estimates put as much as 90% of Muslims in the world at the time were colonized by Europe. And Europeans divided up the Muslim world, and they turned it into various spheres of influence. They turned it into colonies, and they came in often without much consent from the people there and started to impose their vision of what it means to be modern, their vision of what it means to be enlightened, their vision of what it means to be a nation state upon the Muslim world, and begin to push their values and their ideas forcefully upon these largely Muslim populations. And I think we can all agree that that was an incredibly problematic era. At the end of that era, the European powers decided, well, you know, we really don't want to have all of these colonies that we have to manage. That's very expensive. And this is in the aftermath, especially of World War I, they realized we need to rebuild Europe. And then a few decades later had to rebuild it again. And so they said, let's turn them all into nation states. Again, taking this Westphalian notion of what a nation state is, we'll use that to divide up the Muslim world. But those nation states are often governed in their creation by European interests and not by the interests of the people on the ground. So there's a famous moment during World War I where the British and the French, they know the Ottoman Empire is about to be totally defeated in the war, and they're trying to figure out, what do we do after the war? What do we do with this Ottoman Empire that we've been fighting against that is now going to be dissolved? And so several diplomats get together. The British diplomat is a guy named Sykes, and the French diplomat is a guy named Picot. The Russian Empire, this is before the Russian Revolution, is kind of a silent party to the whole agreement. And so Sykes and Picot start drawing lines and saying, okay, here's what the British realm of influence will be, and here's what the French realm of influence will be in the aftermath of the war. And the Russians say, as long as you give us Istanbul, we're fine with whatever you want to do. And so the British and the French, they basically especially draw this line right here, and they say, on this side it will be the British area, and on this side will be the French area of influence. And they both knew that what they were then calling Palestine would be the most troubling area, and so they said, we'll just do something special with Palestine, right? They didn't even really want to dictate that too much. And so that became part of the border drawing that happened in the Middle East. Now, if you look at, and this is a map of the different ethnic and religious makeups of these areas,
the yellow is the Sunni Arabs. The red are the Kurds, who are usually Sunni, generally Sunni, but they're a different ethnic group. The green is the Shia, and up here in Syria, the Alawite, minority Shia sect. And then you have various other Druze and Christian minorities that also populate that area. And we Westerners looked at that and said, country? That's a nation right there. We'll call that Syria. You wonder why there's a civil war today going on in Syria between different factions within the Sunni population and the Alawite governing party, the Alawite governing family, the Assads. Well, some of it is baked in. And part of what the European powers did in this period, especially once you have the beginning of the Cold War, is they would install, sometimes through revolution, sometimes through influence operations, they would install autocrats that they thought would be favorable to them. So Saddam Hussein was backed by the United States up until he wasn't. Muammar Gaddafi was backed by the United States. And oftentimes we in the United States also during the Cold War helped to back the Muslim Brotherhood because we saw them as a good counterbalance to rising Arab socialism. So the West has been mucking around in this region, both through war and through influence, for the better part of a century now. We would often install autocrats because we saw them as stable leaders who would tamp down the what we still saw as intrinsic violence of these civilizations and cultures. What's the LBJ quote? Pardon my presidential French here. He may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. That's been the mentality for most of the last century in terms of American and Western foreign policy towards this region. So what has happened that might be similar to the Reformation in this process? The Muslim world today is having intense debates about the interpretation of Scripture and the role of tradition, two of the guiding parts of the Reformation. We have a variety of religious and political alliances and arrangements. We have Islamists who primarily interpret Islam through a political lens. We have monarchies like in Jordan or Morocco. We have a number of quietists. In fact, the Wahhabis themselves are typically quietists. They don't want to get involved in politics. They have this stark separation between the religious and the political spheres, and they might want to be dictatorial in the religious spheres, but they give the Saudi royal family a pass on just about everything. They won't criticize them. You have rebellious militants, right? This, in many ways, looks more like Europe in the immediate aftermath of the Reformation, where you have new political alliances that are going on, than it does like something pre-Reformation. We have layers of cultural and national identity and ethnicity that are all in the mix, and theology and confessional identity enter that same mix, and so suddenly you have different communities that are identifying themselves via religion, but that often is more about ethnic signaling or national signaling. In Turkey today, there's been a resurgence over the last decade in women wearing the hijab. I was in Turkey in 2003 and 2006. There were a few women who would wear the hijab, but it was not a big deal. But over the last decade, it has become a part of the national narrative that women should wear the hijab. And you could say that that's been a revolution in religious piety, but it has a lot to do also with the ruling party and how they frame nationalism. It's as much about politics as it is about religion. And so all of those things get layered on top of all of these other things. And today, just like in the Protestant movement, there's no central authority. There's no one unifying figure who speaks for Islam. There is no pope for Islam, although there are people who will claim that role and say, I get to speak for Islam, and they often have a very violent interpretation of Islam. So the movement that I study, the movement that I work with, and I focus mostly on them here in the U.S., is this movement called the Salafis. The Salafis are a complicated movement. It arises in the 20th century. So it's connected to this movement of the Wahhabis that still exists in Saudi Arabia, but it also has a distinct overlap. It's more of a 20th century movement, and it is more it grows out of all of these different reform movements in Sunni Islam in the 20th century, some in South Asia, some in Southeast Asia, some in the Middle East. Once this movement arises, the Wahhabis realize we don't really want to be called Wahhabis. They never liked being called Wahhabis because it makes them sound like they're followers of Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, who is this eccentric figure of the 18th century. And they're like, no, we aren't Wahhabis. We are Muslims, or we are followers of the Prophet. And the Salafis, the Salaf, are the righteous ancestors, the first three generations of Muslims. And the Salafis believe that the Salaf lived this pristine experience of Islam, this pure and righteous Islam that has only degraded through the centuries. And so the Wahhabis, as soon as this movement starts arising, calling itself Salafism, they're like, oh, we'll call ourselves Salafis. That's a better term. That more accurately captures who we are. And then there are other voices in Salafism that are arguing against the Wahhabi trend. So it's this complex 20th century movement that the Salafis as a whole set aside the traditional authorities, the traditional schools of law in Islam, the schools of jurisprudence, and they argue for direct access to the scriptural text. They'll call themselves sometimes the Protestant reformers of Islam. And the Salafis, they are, of course, very interested in the Quran, but they're more interested in some ways in the Hadith. Because the Hadith, as I said, are the sayings and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. There are these thousands and thousands of memories of the Prophet Muhammad. Sometimes it'll be just a single sentence that he said. Sometimes it'll be a little story about the Prophet or about one of the companions of the Prophet. And what the Hadith, because they're an incredibly complex body of literature, they've been the realm of scholars throughout the Muslim history. And scholars would develop a specialization in the Hadith, and you really had to have this specialization in order to study the Hadith. And what the Salafis have done is popularized the Hadith. They've called for everyone to be able to read and study the Hadith. And they've created apps for the Hadith so you can read the Hadith on your phone. And they've created translation databases of the Hadith so that everyone can go. And they encourage this direct access to the Hadith. They encourage everyone, everyday Muslims, to read and study this scripture, the Quran and the Hadith, for themselves. And they're really good preachers. They're very effective communicators. They're very popular in the way that they put forward their vision of what Islam is. And again, they in some ways model themselves after the Protestant reformers, or at least call back to that and say that's similar to what we are doing with Islam today. We are popularizing scripture. We're putting scripture in the hands of the people. We're setting aside all of these cultural accretions. We're setting aside all these superstitions to get back to pure and pristine and original Islam. So on the more extremist side of the Salafi movement, you would have the jihadi Salafis. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are Salafi movements, but they're from this jihadi side. And they use this Salafi discourse, this Salafi conversation about the Hadith, in order to justify the attacks that they have. So they pick out some of the more violent elements of the Quran and the Hadith, and they say, this is the model of the Prophet. This is the model of the Salaf. This is what we should be doing. And of course, there are other Salafis who argue against that and say that that is a completely wrong interpretation, but they're all participating within this larger discourse about the Hadith. So, before we come to some question and answer time, does Islam need a reformation? I would say whether Islam needed one or not, it got one. And a reformation of sorts has already happened in the Muslim world. The sacred texts are in the hands of the people, and they are being interpreted in a wide variety of ways. They've been taken out of the hands of the older authorities. Those old hierarchies of authority, both political and religious, have been destabilized over the last 100 years. You have new political identities and religious alliances that have formed around nation states and around ethnic identities. And these theological disputes that Muslims are having have spilled over into intense violence, often intense international or intranational violence. I would say that, if anything, the Muslim world is living in the aftermath of a Reformation-like event. The Muslim world today looks more like late 16th and early 17th century Europe than it does like pre-Reformation Europe. The chaos that we, as a Protestant movement, experienced, that we, in some ways, inflicted upon Europe, is in many ways similar to what we're seeing in the Muslim world today. Let me draw out just a few lessons for us, some things that we could maybe take away from all this. Mark Twain is credited with saying, though I haven't found any confirmation that he ever actually said it, that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And I would say that there's not a perfect parallel between the Reformation and what has happened in the Muslim world in the last 100 years, but there's a rhyme there. There's enough similarities that we can recognize ourselves and our own experience in what we've seen there. And the West and Western Christianity doesn't have any high moral ground from which to stand and cast aspersions. Our history and our theology is entangled with violence, and with politicized religion, and with countless abuses. We are not the moral exemplar tradition that we sometimes make ourselves out to be. We have great things about us. There's a dark side to our own history as well. The virtues of humility and honesty would do both sides in the Muslim-Christian divide some good. And there are hopeful signs of that. I was invited, along with a colleague of mine at Georgetown, to a gathering of some of the most elite Muslim clerics in the United States at the United States Institute of Peace, to think about this question of, if we can say that Islam is experiencing something like the Reformation today, what lessons could Muslim leaders learn from Christian history? And my colleague and I had to think through how do we approach that question with some humility and talk about the negative lessons that we learned. And maybe there's something more positive. And I think that that might be something that we could offer in humility, in honesty. Perhaps some of the negative lessons that we've learned over the last 500 years could benefit our Muslim friends. Again, offered in a spirit of generosity and humility, acknowledging our own sins in the process. But perhaps it won't take 500 years to repair some of the breaches that have occurred within the Islamic community in the last century. Perhaps we can accelerate that process a bit as friends. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions you have. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So in both cases, I think you have as I spoke about last week, the Reformation is spurred by this information age that's created by the printing press in the middle of the 15th century, and the reformers build upon that technology to spread their ideas all over Europe in a very rapid fashion. And so they're using kind of this new technology in order to bolster their case. And yes, incredibly disruptive new technology. You also have to factor in that the Reformation was happening right at the beginning of the Age of Exploration, where suddenly, right, 1492, Columbus is sailing. 25 years later, Martin Luther is nailing his 95 Theses. So the suddenly you have this influx of wealth as well into Europe. That is also a factor, an economic factor, in these Reformation battles and wars. And so I would say there is a parallel in what has happened in Saudi Arabia and really in the other Gulf states as well. There are parallel elements happening in some of the other Gulf states where you have wealth that can spread influence and spread a particular vision of what Islam is, and that has fueled this Saudi printing agency. The other thing that is fascinating is the Salafis are they just inhabit the internet. The internet is kind of native territory to them, and so a Salafi cleric can get his sermons up on YouTube far faster than Martin Luther could get his treatises published on a printing press, right? And so part of the influence that the Salafis have, as I said, they're very good preachers. They're very compelling in the ways that they present Islam. And they're making a claim to authenticity in the same way that the Protestant reformers were. We're getting back to real Christianity. And that authenticity is very appealing to many people. It's seen as I'm finding the true dope. I'm finding the real religion, as opposed to all of this mucky, icky historical process stuff. And so there's a power in claiming that you have recovered the original vision, especially when that power is backed by new technology and newfound wealth. It can be an incredibly influential thing. Yeah.
Thank you very much for two excellent presentations so far. I like these points very, very much. And I just want to make a comment on the fourth point.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And 3 or 4 years ago, we had a special committee to work on understanding the Catholic traditions and so on. And I was the only non-Catholic, I was the only Protestant in the group. I wanted to know more about Catholicism. And we read very important documents emanating from Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the statements in one of those documents made a reference to
the Crusades.
The Crusades. And one of the important documents emanating from the Vatican, referring to the Crusades, said they were, and this is an actual quotation, a travesty.
Mm-hmm.
In our conversation, that I said, if that can be publicized, especially in the Muslim world, it can create a lot of understanding. At this point here, it is an excellent one, but perhaps that example goes back about 1,000 years,
beyond
the 500 you mentioned over here. But this is a very important.
Yeah, and as I mentioned last week, the within the Muslim world, the Crusades were seen as this idiosyncratic episode. It was not seen as a civilizational conflict. They were like, oh, some crazy French people came in and took over Jerusalem for 70 years, and then we kicked them out. So it was not perceived as this great clash of civilizations as we in the West have tended to think about the Crusades. But it's in this period of European colonialism, as the Muslim world is colonized by Europe, and they realize what a paradigmatic moment the Crusades was for Europe, that you have a term in Arabic coined for crusader, Salabiya. And when you go and read what ISIS writes, the way that ISIS or Al-Qaeda formulates their understanding of the West, they will always call Western soldiers crusaders, Salabiya. Interestingly, in the aftermath of 9/11, at one point, just a few weeks after 9/11, George W. Bush was walking to his helicopter and was asked a question about the ongoing operations in Afghanistan, and he dropped the word crusade in his off-the-cuff answer. He said, this crusade, and then the White House had to clean it up afterwards. But from Al-Qaeda's perspective, that confirmed everything that they believed. They saw that as the truth, the underlying truth. This really is a religious war between Christians and Muslims. So the Crusades today have incredible resonance in the Muslim world, and there's a deeply felt grievance. But I would argue that there's more of a grievance about colonialism than it was about the Crusades themselves, but the Crusades have become kind of a symbolic factor in that. Yes. Between Christians and Muslims? I guess it depends on what we mean by reconciliation. If we mean by reconciliation that we all will become a single movement, I think one of the lessons that we've learned since the Reformation, and I'll talk about this a little bit next week as well, is that reconciliation doesn't necessarily mean that we're all the same. But it might mean that the quality of our disagreements has improved, and that those disagreements don't necessarily divide us in the same way. I think one of the real tragedies, and this was some of what I mentioned last week, is that we have tended to think of the Abrahamic family of faith as being about Judaism and Christianity, with Muslims and Islam being the redheaded stepchild that came along too late and was always outside of our discourse. I think the historical reality is that all three of these traditions grew up as sibling traditions in the Mediterranean in the late antique period. And Islam and Muslims are very much a part of the Abrahamic conversation that we're having. Now, that doesn't mean that at the end of the day, Muslims and Christians are all going to agree. In fact, within Islam, the Quran is fairly explicit that Jesus is not the Son of God, and that the Quran, speaking to Christians, says, say not three but one, right? Don't push this doctrine of the Trinity. It's very much taking a position on that. It's hard for me to imagine historic Christianity giving up the divinity of Jesus or the Trinity as theological ideas. But I think that doesn't bar us from friendship, from cooperation, from working together, and from really understanding some of the Muslim critiques of our own religious tradition. I think that's entirely possible. So, again, it depends on what we mean by reconciliation. If reconciliation means that we're all conforming to a watered-down definition of what religion is, that's not how many people feel about religion. They care deeply about the things that they've been raised with. But if we can find bridge points and things that are places of commonality, I think there can be a lot more understanding. Any other questions? Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, I could speak for another hour on that question. So I taught a class on religion and international affairs at GW last semester, and I had these students who were all international affairs majors who came in with a lot of ideas about the separation of church and state. We actually sat down and looked at what is the arrangement that most of the world has. And if you look at how the United States thinks about the separation of church and state, it's basically the only country in the world that thinks about it that way. There's still an official religion in most of Europe, right? The Queen of England is the head of the Church of England, and that is more the typical arrangement between religion and state around the world than what we have. So there's all kinds of formulations of what do we mean by the separation of church and state. Does that mean that there can be no official religion, which is what we in America have tended to operate with? Does it mean that religions, that there needs to be a tolerance of pluralism, even if there is an official religion? That's how most of Europe and a lot of other countries have arranged things, that there can be an official religion, but we can tolerate pluralism, religious pluralism within our borders. Does it mean that there are some sanctioned religions and others that are not sanctioned? That's the arrangement that Russia has. It recognizes Islam and Eastern Orthodox Christianity, doesn't like the evangelicals very much. It recognizes Buddhism, but there are five acceptable ones, other ones are not. Indonesia is the same way. There's five acceptable religions, others not. China has a similar arrangement. All of those are in ways trying to manage the problem that the Westphalian state is handed, right? How do you govern religion within your boundaries, especially in places where there is a clear religious majority that could, in a democratic society, impose its will, could step in and start legislating religion as law? So sometimes when we talk about, what the Muslim world needs is democratization, that's intrinsically in tension with what we value in the separation of church and state. In 2012, after the Arab Spring, and Mubarak was deposed as the autocrat that we were propping up, the Egyptians had free and fair elections. Guess who won? Muslim Brotherhood, right? This Islamist movement. Guess who came in second? The Salafis. The Salafis were just right behind the Muslim Brotherhood in terms of the number of seats in parliament that they got. And as soon as the Muslim Brotherhood started actually doing what they said they were going to do as a party and said, we're going to govern by the Quran, and we're going to govern by Sharia, by Islamic law, then we in the West got really antsy and said, it's religious autocracy. They won. They won the democratic election. And so when the military decided to depose the Muslim Brotherhood president, we said, okay. It was a military coup. And we said, that's fine. We'll let Assisi come in and govern and start brutally killing hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood activists, because in our view, that was more aligned with our foreign policy interests. So I think it's a very complicated question, actually, when we try to boil it down. What is the status of separation of church and state? Can Islam tolerate secularism? And by secularism, if we mean this separation of church and state, I think absolutely. Because I look at Muslims in the West, the Muslims that I study, and they love democracy because they're Westerners. They fit all the kind of same ideas that we hold, except that they're Muslims. And so I study Salafis in America and some of the adaptations that they're making in America, and it's fascinating because you'll hear these Salafi clerics in America who absolutely sincerely will say that democracy is the way, is the guiding ideology of Islam. And democracy is a logical outcome of Islam. And they use the Hadith and they use the Quran to put that forward and say, no, that we should be voting and mobilizing in democratic elections because that is our duty as Muslims. Now, their colleagues in Saudi Arabia would make a completely different argument using the Hadith. But that's part of the pluralization of interpretation that has happened. So I think Islam can, in whatever different way you want to think about Islam, it can handle all kinds of different political arrangements. There happens to be a dominant political arrangement today in the Middle East that often doesn't fit with our view. But I think we also have to have a historical sense of how we got to the separation of church and state value that we have, and not necessarily assume that everyone else should just accept our conclusion to that process, because most people haven't. Is that any other questions? I think we have a few minutes left. Yeah, yeah. So in some ways, Islam is not quite as troubled by modern science as we Christians, especially we Protestants, have been. The Catholics have done a much better job of taking modern science on board. We Protestants had this whole episode of fundamentalism, a rebellion against the dominance of Western science and scientific worldview, because of the threat that it posed to the Bible. The Quran is much more elusive in the way that it talks about history, the way it talks about creation. So there's a creation narrative in the Quran, but there isn't a genealogy that's attached to it that we Christians and Jews happen to have to grapple with, right? So in our Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, you can date creation if you follow the genealogies, and that's where you get this hypothesis or idea or belief that the earth is 6,000 or 10,000 years old, depending on how you do the math. So that became very problematic for us, and we spent several hundred years grappling with that, and many people still are. How do you assimilate modern science? The Quran doesn't give those kind of dates and figures. And interestingly, many of the leaders in the Salafi movement are trained in the STEM fields. They're doctors, and they're engineers, and they're biologists. And if you look at the way that the Salafis interact with the Hadith, it's very scientific. It's very much, oh, we need to sort, and we've got this many Hadith on this side, and we need to put this, right? It's a very scientific approach to texts. It's not a literary approach so much. It's not coming out of the humanities so much as it's coming out of science. So there definitely are elements of challenge that modern science has posed to Islam, especially particular hadith that seem like they are not in conformity with the conclusions of modern science. There's a famous story about this Saudi cleric, Ibn Baz, who puts out a fatwa. A fatwa is just an opinion of a scholar. It's not binding in any way, but he puts out a fatwa. This was in the middle of the 20th century. Puts out a fatwa on the impossibility of human beings interacting, walking on the moon, because he says it's an impossibility. The Quran doesn't mention it. It's not possible. And then one of the Saudi princes gets taken up to the International Space Station and comes back. And Ibn Baz, who's blind, sits down with this Saudi prince to hear about his experience. And as soon as he hears from somebody that he knows who had this experience going up into outer space, he's like, okay, I'll withdraw the fatwa. Right, so it's partly an experiential thing for them, right? If you're reasoning from within a religious worldview, and there's incredible amounts of conspiratorial thinking in the Muslim world, in part because of these historical circumstances. As long if it's Westerners and Western scientists who are promoting this idea, they intrinsically doubt it, not because it's scientific, but because it's Western. But in this case, because he knew somebody. Well, he's able to rethink that. So it's not there are not quite the same issues and tensions that we have felt and wrestled with in Protestantism, especially in the Muslim world. There definitely are points of tension, but it's not seen as the same conversation really that we've had. Yeah. I don't have that kind of hubris. I don't know. So there's a famous theory that arises in the time of the Enlightenment, and this theory is that as the world becomes modern, it will become more secular. And by secular, they don't mean separation of religion and state. They meant that as well, but they mean that the world will become more atheist. Right. Religion is this element from the past, this ancient instincts that we need to evolve out of. And there's a famous Jefferson quote that he wrote that by the end of my life, I can't imagine that all of the men of the world will not be Unitarians.
And so then this becomes a scientific theory that people start working with in the 20th century, and you have these famous secularization theorists who are saying, well, now that the rest of the world is developing, they're all going to become irreligious. The atheism is going to grow. And the wonderful thing about secularization theory is how universally wrong it has been. And it was wrong in the 18th century, right? Jefferson, everyone's going to become Unitarians. And what happens in the 19th century? The Second Great Awakening, right? That everyone becomes evangelical, right? And then in the 20th century, oh, now that the rest of the world is going to be developed, they're all going to become secular too. The only place that secularization theory has even remotely been proven true is in Northern Europe. And even there, when people go back and look at Northern Europe historically, it never was that religious. There have been historical surveys that have been done in England and in Northern Europe of the foundations of churches. And how many people could you fit in a church service on any given Sunday morning? And we know from the historical records, from the texts, they were usually only having one service. About 10% of the population of Northern Europe could have fit inside a church at any given point in the Middle Ages. It was never that religious. That was the myth that was created by the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Oh, those Dark Ages were all superstition and religion. They actually weren't that religious in Europe. But the world is incredibly religious today. In fact, 84% of the world identifies with some religious tradition, and many people cling to that very dutifully. They really hold on to that religious identity. In fact, I would argue that modernity has increased the amount of religion because it's increased the access people have. It's increased their agency with religion. And that's part of what the Salafis are drawing upon, is that you could have more agency in your Islam. You can study the Hadith for yourself, right? That's an empowering message. You could even say that's a democratizing message. But as the world has become more modern, I would say, if anything, more people. And Rodney Stark, who's a sociologist, has done really good work on this, both in America and around the globe, showing both the silliness of secularization, the secularization thesis, but also how much more religious we are than our forebears. So all that to say, my prediction is only, I don't think religion's going anywhere. Yeah. You're giving me the easy questions this morning. So I have 1 minute. So I would say there is no single Islamic view of gender and of women. When we talk about Sharia, Sharia is a conversation. It's a conversation about law. It's a conversation about the Hadith and the Quran. And it's a conversation that's been going on for well over 700 years now. And so the way that part of the challenge that we have as Christians is our predominant discourse is theological. Our major fights and disagreements have been about theology because we have these complicated theological ideas like the Trinity and the divinity and humanity of Jesus that have kept us debating over the centuries. Theology is fairly simple within Islam. It's one God, Muhammad's his prophet. You're good, right? And then what do you do? The whole conversation is about what do you do? So that's where jurisprudence becomes the predominant conversation. And jurisprudence is just another word for Sharia. So Sharia is just how do you think about what it means to be Muslim and how to live as a Muslim in light of the Quran and the Hadith. And these scholars throughout the centuries have talked and thought about that and issued millions of opinions. There's a story about the late Ottoman Empire. As the Ottomans were trying to modernize, they were trying to become this modern empire, and they said, there's four major schools of law in Islam. Let's just pick one of them, the Hanafis. We'll put a bunch of scholars in a room and have them hammer out a modern code of laws that we can then govern our empire by, and we'll be a modern empire. So they put these scholars in a room, say, work it out. And the scholars come back a year later, and they say, not possible. Not possible. And one of them gives the quote, it was like we were adrift on a sea without shores. The Sharia is, it's an ocean of conversation and discourse.
So there's all kinds of things that are very positive about women. There's all kinds of things that are very negative about women within that discourse. And so it's not a question in my mind of whether Sharia can be positive towards women. It's, well, who's interpreting Sharia? Who's using Sharia? And Islam is much more like Judaism in that it's much more of an orthopraxic religion, more of a focus on what you do than what you believe. Of course, what you believe is important, but it's fairly simple, so you can have a conversation more about behavior. So I'm happy to talk more on that question. It's an enormous question. Thank you very much for having me, and I'll see you next week.